Okay, welcome back everyone. So this is just a really exciting turnout. It's great. I see a number of new faces. So it's really nice to have you. Do I have everyone's name? I think I'm trying to see. Anyone? No.
Okay.
We've met. We just met. I mean, a few moments ago. How are you?
Hi.
Good.
Oh, his wife.
I gotcha. Okay, very nice. What's your first name?
Wilma.
Nice to meet you. Thank you. Okay, great. And I think pretty much everyone who has been here.
Violet Samuels.
Oh, hi. How are you? Okay, good. You were here. We've met. Yes. Okay. Good. Very nice. So it's great to see everyone. I think those who have what. And also, yes, new also. You were here once, right? Remind me your name again, I'm sorry. Okay, Sally, okay. Very nice, good. All right, so we're good. So where I think we have people, it's, you know, sort of people who have been here previously are all here, and we're all here, so it's really, really great. And I want to thank everyone for coming out in what is probably not the best weather we could have ordered for today. It could have been worse, though, and if it were last winter, it probably would have been worse. So we know what the alternatives could be, so we're grateful for that. And today, we're obviously in the spirit of Hanukkah. We're not; it's not too far off. Just basically a week away from Hanukkah, which is really exciting. Last year, I think it was later in the year. It was later on the calendar because there was a leap.
Last year was earlier.
This year is later. Last year was Thanksgiving. That's right. We invented a new holiday. Other way around. Last year was very early. That's right. Thank you for reminding me. And this year we do not have any new holidays to invent on the Jewish calendar. So it's just plain old Hanukkah this year. What I wanted to do is to examine something that has some historical aspects to it and has always intrigued me, and I see it intrigued some of us because we came prepared with our own sources, and to examine together a little bit about the history of the menorah. We know that, of course, the Chanukiah, that the candles that we light on the upcoming holiday of Hanukkah are, of course, built upon really an extension of the rededication of the menorah in the temple itself. So I'm sure we all remember the basic storyline, that what had happened was there was war. It was actually, if you're familiar, there was actually a civil war that to some degree broke out amongst the Jews themselves. There were Hellenists who wanted to remake the temple itself and to refashion the temple and Jewish practice and to sort of fuse it with Hellenist themes. And there were others who pushed back and felt that although we should be excellent members of society and we should of course be part of society, at the same time we should be careful before we overly sort of remake Judaism in the image of Hellenism, and that there are certain basic differences and we have to be true to our Jewish traditions, and there are even times when we need to fight for that. And unfortunately things went from bad to worse, as unfortunately happens, and there was a need for war, but ultimately the family of Judah and his brothers, right, the Maccabee brothers, right, the Chashmonai family, the Chashmonaim as we call them, were ultimately victorious. They rededicated the temple, and classically, as is known to us all, they rededicated it in particular by rekindling the lights of the menorah. And that, of course, is the symbol, or one of the symbols of Hanukkah. So there's sort of two competing symbols which are actually relevant as a frame for our conversation today, that really relevant for the holiday. Because what was the miracle? On the one hand, you have the physical military victory, right, which we describe in the prayers of Hanukkah as well. We talk about the idea that God handed over the many in the hands of the small, right, the impure in the hands of the pure, and so on and so forth. So we have the military aspect of the victory, but we also have, of course, the imagery of the menorah and the light, and that doesn't seem to be so much physical, of course, as more of a spiritual kind of symbolism. Light, right? Light as something that rises, something that doesn't have the same kind of physicality properties, certainly as a battlefield. So those are very different kinds of symbols, and these are almost... if not competing, certainly complementary symbols as to what Hanukkah is all about. And I think it's actually, in that sense, a very beautiful statement about Jewish values and the idea that the material, that the physical and the spiritual, we do not believe them to be conflicting, to be contradictory. We believe that to be a good Jew, we need to be out there in the world to be materially successful. But at the same time, if it's just materialism, and certainly if it's just crass materialism, if it's not about the greater good and supporting our family and giving back to society, of course, that's not what we represent. So this idea of the balance between the physical, the military, on the one hand, and the spiritual on the other, is symbolized by the menorah. I think really, in many ways, a sort of that fusion really represents what Judaism is all about. And so that's why I always thought that these two symbols are very beautifully symbolic as to what Hanukkah really represents. What I want to do today, though, is to focus on the menorah in particular, and really what we light nowadays is really a representation of what was done in the temple itself, the menorah that was lit by the priests in the temple, and that was rededicated by that family at that time after the conclusion, or at the conclusion of the wars. I wanted to look at this symbol. And I wanted to look at it through the lens of a historical symbol, a very famous one, the Arch of Titus, which is what I had mentioned in the lecture title. Now, the Arch of Titus is famous for many, 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 many reasons. If you take a look at, I know the picture did not come out great. I gave you the classic picture. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. If you take a look on the staple source sheets in number 3, it didn't come out super clearly, but I think it's clear enough. Right? I think it came out. What? On page 3 of the stapled source sheets, the second side. Source 3. Did I say page 3? It's page 2, source 3. Do you have it? I have an extra, don't you worry.
Where is the...
Does everyone have? Do we need one more, or we're okay? I have one more if we need.
That's what he was talking about.
No, we're okay? Here, there's one extra sheet. You can pass it back. Okay? Take the staple. You want the stapled one as well. There are 2 sheets that I have. We're good. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, we are good. All right. Okay, so I think everyone has it now. So if you take a look on page 2 of the stapled sheets in source 3, you have the very famous picture of the menorah, the Arch of Titus. Who is represented in this picture?
Romans brought back.
Okay, so these are right. So this is after the destruction, right? This is the Romans. So this is after the destruction of the first or the second temple?
Second.
The second temple is right. Who destroyed the first temple? Which country? Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of, right, the Babylonians. So the Babylonians destroy the first temple and the Romans the second. And this is, of course, the Roman conquest. They're carrying away the vessels of the temple, right? You have, again, a little bit hard to see, but these are, right, who's walking here? We have Roman soldiers, and we have Jewish captives, right? Slaves who have been taken into captivity, and then they're carrying together with them the Roman soldiers, right? Most prominently,
the Hanukkah.
Right? You have the menorah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the menorah.
I can't see the far side.
What? The menorah.
Something else.
What
is the other thing they're killing?
Okay, no problem. All good.
What is the other thing they're killing?
What is the other thing they are carrying? It's hard to tell for sure. It seems like it's some sort of vessel from the temple. It might be the ark, actually, but it's hard to say for sure.
It looks like an old-fashioned movie camera. I don't think
it does. They were prescient. It was a prophetic picture of a movie camera. No, that's an unlikely interpretation.
So
that's right. It's
misunderstanding.
That's right. And then they post it to YouTube, right? They post it on the internet. That's right. For all to see the destruction.
The one over here.
Yeah.
Next to the menorah, looks like a movie camera.
Coffee.
They had that.
Wow. Yeah. What? It's pretty funny.
Before they use their cell phones.
All right. Good. Now.
It's a vessel called the.
Yeah. Oh, there's another one. Here's a 2 of them.
There's that's why I said the ark, but there's 2.
There's
3
of them. 1, 2, 3 of those, whatever they are.
Hard to see. I guess they wanted multiple angles for the
I think you could be
camera.
Right that it's a chalice with 2 handles on each side.
It might be.
You see?
It's
because there's 3 of them.
Yeah.
Where do you see that?
See, here's 1, here's 2, and here's 3.
Chalice is something you drink for.
Don't they all look similar?
Yes.
I don't know what it is. It's a good question.
In particular, look almost.
You have to. You need a sharper picture, I think, also. I don't know. Okay, so that's so this is a very famous image, and it's a sad image from our perspective, in the sense that certainly it's a picture, it's an image of destruction. But it's famous for many, many, many reasons, and you're familiar with them. And what I'd like to do is to examine, actually, interestingly enough, the architecture of the menorah as portrayed in this very famous picture. And I'd like to examine actually two interesting aspects. The first one is more of just sort of a historical curiosity, an interesting detail, and the second is going to already be even more significant. So the first one I'd like to examine is to ask a very basic question about the physical construction of the menorah in the temple. Okay, and let's start, if you'll join me, on page number one. If you go back to the first side, let's read, just to get a sense as to the details that God assigns Moses. This is in the description for the construction, not of the temple in Jerusalem, but rather this is the tabernacle, the Mishkan, which wandered with the Jews in the desert, and then ultimately entered the land of Israel and dwelt in numerous cities in the land of Israel, prior to the construction of the actual Beit HaMikdash, of the temple itself. So let's take a look in the description
on their
here.
Shoulders is a big box. So could that be...
Maybe that's probably the ark. I think
you
the ark
see?
Is part of it.
It's a great big box that they're carrying
that's
on
the
their
one.
Shoulders on the
that's
right.
That's not what
the
Mishkan looked like.
I don't think so.
I don't
that's
know.
Not
well,
what it looked like.
Well, part of the question, though, is how accurate this really was. That's going to be part of the question we're going to have to look at, which is an interesting problem.
Could it possibly be something, when the Kohanim...
I'm freezing. I know. I'm not taking my
There's a basin. It's called the kior, the basin that they would use to wash the feet. I don't know. I'm not sure. I have to look at it more. I want to see them. Yeah.
It has a handle.
Right. Did they carry it on with the water and off?
There was such a thing. It's possible. I'm not sure.
Just a thought.
Yeah, could be.
Up like a placard would be stuck. Here comes the robot.
That could be. All right. Good. So now I'd like to. So let's take a look. Back on page number one, if you'll join me. If you take a look, let's just read the English together, and let's see the description, according to the Bible, according to Chumash, as to how the menorah is constructed. What did it look like? So let's read that together. So I'm in where it says verse 31 on the left in the English. Thou shalt make a candlestick of pure gold. So the first thing that we learn about this candlestick, or what we call the menorah, is that it's made of pure gold. What does that mean, pure gold? Right? It means it was a single, right, it was hammered, exactly, it was one single piece of gold that Moses was commanded to essentially reshape, to mold into the shape of the menorah. In fact, the law was, interestingly enough, that if the menorah in the temple was constructed of various component parts that were then attached to one another, it was disqualified. It was not actually a proper menorah. It was actually constructed from one single unified piece of gold, pure gold. That was
pure gold without any alloys in it. Would
without
be
any
soft.
Alloys, would be soft enough. Right. Well, they would. It would be beaten work, right? You see, that's what it says. So it says a beaten work. You couldn't overdo it, right?
Yeah.
A beaten work. Shall the candlestick be made? His shaft, his branches. Let's take a look at each of these. His bowls. His knobs, it says knobs, but knobs, and his flowers shall be of the same. What does that refer to? What is the shaft? What are the branches? What are these bowls? What in the world are we talking about? Right? So it actually, underneath the candle, there were aesthetic dimensions to the menorah. It wasn't just the candlestick. There were these decorations that were that went along with it. And we'll see a picture of that in just a few moments. If you look at verse 32, and six branches shall come out of the sides of it. Three branches of the candlestick out of one side, three branches of the candlestick on out of the other side. Right? Now we'll see later on that there were seven branches altogether. So clearly there's one central branch, right? And then you have, fanning out on either side. And in pretty much all of our menorahs, you see you have one central branch, and then you have them, sort of fanning out, three to one side, three to the other side. And I just want to mention This is unheard of, a very unusual opinion. But there was actually one view among the medieval scholars who actually maintains that it's not correct that it was constructed in this way. One in the middle, and then three on either side. There's one view that maintained that each of the branches had to be equidistant.
Had what?
Had to be equidistant to the middle branch.
That's kind of hard.
Okay, so if that's the case, you construct the menorah of the temple. Say it again, louder.
In a circle.
In a circle. Believe it or not, I know this is not what we usually think. It's certainly not what we do
is equal.
In our
no
homes.
No one's more important than the
That's the idea. If it represents, let's say, for example, some say that it represents the different branches of wisdom, or that the six that are surrounded, the six surrounding branches represent the different types of people in the world, or different members of the Jewish community, or whatever it may be. What? Okay, right? Whatever exactly it is that it represents, they're all equidistant. One is not more important than the other. And what's the central one? Right? Is God, right? Or maybe it's the Torah, whatever it may be, but it represents that which is of ultimate significance. So that's actually a fascinating opinion. Again, that's not what's generally assumed, but you should know there, you know, that there's some really interesting ideas out there.
How could it be in the circle? How could it be in this circle? It goes with the base, which is six sides.
Well, we're going to have to talk about what the base really looks like. So hold on, 1 second.
Why do we have seven here?
1 second.
I don't know.
I don't understand. How could you have it around?
Yes.
And then one in the middle?
No. Well, you wouldn't have one in the middle.
Sure you could.
Well, I mean, but if you wanted them all equal distance, you just have the circle.
But equidistant from the one in the middle as well.
But the menorah, they have.
That's right. Equidistant from the one in the middle. So you have one shaft going up.
Is that supposed to be knob and not knob?
And equally from the diamond
center
in the middle, you would have six.
So and if, how would that take
around? And if you attach them, you would have a hexagon of equal size. And then the radii, right? The radii from each point on the hexagon to the midpoint would be identical, would be the same.
But we should go with the one
Well, we're going to talk about that.
But the one in the picture isn't.
They put it as they cut it.
They had to cut it.
Yeah.
Complicated.
So can you have one in the middle that's separated from all the others? If the others are around, how do you have one?
Well, you have one. There's going to be something on the bottom that connects all to one another.
This is not a
question. That's not this picture. We'll see.
This
is not the picture. Okay.
Is it supposed to be K-N-O-P? Is that knob? Is that supposed to be the word knob?
Yeah, it's really a knob. I don't know why it came out that way. I don't know what a knob is.
I'm not familiar.
It's usually translated as a knob. Okay, now, I'm not going to read all of the verses here, but if you read, it gives each of the details. Right. It does stress that there were seven lamps altogether. That's where we got the idea. Seven is in 37. If you take a look at verse 37, and thou shalt make the seven lamps thereof, right? And they shall light the lamps thereof, and that they should give light against it. So it's contradictory. And this is where the idea that there are six that go, six branches come out of the sides, whatever that means. Right, even if it's not the circle, but coming out of the sides, but there's one central part of the menorah, which is number one, and then you have two, three, four, five, six, seven, or however exactly you construct it, coming out of the sides. Okay, now if you... That's part of where Rosenzweig, who a famed philosopher, got the idea in part. Yeah. So it's relevant, 100%. Now, if you take a look at the standalone picture, you will see a little bit less clear. I apologize, it's in black and white. But I think it at least suffices for our purposes in that what you can see is, right, this is actually from the Machon HaMikdash. Anyone familiar with this organization? This is an organization that has that believes that we should be preparing for at least the possibility of the Messiah coming. Now, that's not to say that we know anything with certainty, right, after all of this exile. It'd be probably pretty hard to make a bold prediction at this point. I think we might all be skeptical if someone came and said, you know, I know exactly when. We've been saying that for long enough to know that we can't know for sure. But what they do believe is that we are closer than we have been for the last 2,000 years. Which is not, I think, an unreasonable at least aspiration.
It's time to we get closer anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, right. The question is, are we like within like 5 years or, you know, by another 5,000? That's right. All right, we hope not. That's for sure. Okay, so if you take a look at this is the Machon HaMikdash, what they do is they create replicas of the various vessels of the temple in an attempt to, number one, educate the public as to what these items look like, and number two, as an attempt that if it should ever come to pass in our lifetime, in our days, that indeed the Messianic era should dawn, may it come soon, we'd be properly prepared. I kid you not, this is what they do. They're not a bunch of crazies, they're not people who have lost it, who are off, wearing, white robes and running around at the Kotel or something like that. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? People dressed in white and seeing the beggars at the temple. It's not like that, right? It's not...
Years ago, I took classes in Shabbos, and I understand there's a group, I guess that's the name, that they lay out their Shabbos clothes every night in case the Mashiach should come during the night.
So that's the idea. No, I'm talking about a different group of people. I'm talking about people who are not of sound mind, in this case, who are inhabit the Kotel. Anyone know what I'm talking about? There are beggars at the Kotel who dress up in white and imagine themselves to be the Messiah and need to collect a certain amount of funds in order to bring to make sure that they can discharge their responsibility to the greater world. These are people of very sound mind who are really trying to prepare ourselves for that eventuality. Now, they've done their best to reconstruct the menorah, although the truth is there are different opinions as to, as we're already learning, how exactly the menorah was constructed. There's not just one tradition. There are general assumptions that are shared, but there's some significant details that are subject to dispute. So if you take a look, though, you'll see some of the features that were mentioned in the verses. A little bit hard to see, but if you take a look at toward the top of each of the branches, toward that you'll see three little bowls over there. Can you see there are three little rims?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. A little bit hard to see, but on each of them, you can see that. And then there's a flower. Again, hard to make out that it's a flower, I apologize.
Yeah.
Right? And then you have... Right, exactly.
The top is the bowl to hold the
No, the three... The bowls are the bottom.
Why the bottom? It's at the very top to hold the oil,
isn't
it?
But it describes three bowls made of, like, if you look at verse 33, you've got three bowls made like unto almonds, right? So the three bowls are the bottom section. And then you have the knob and the flower, right? So the knob is the top, and I believe the flower is the thicker part, I believe. Okay? So you can start to see, again, it doesn't look as clear on this picture, but you can get a sense as to what these things are. You can also see, right, and this already is going to be interesting for our purposes, what is the shape of the branches of the menorah, if I were to ask you? Right, they are circular, right? They are circular branches, okay? Is that similar to or different from semicircular? Correct, that's what I mean. Not like the other position, that's correct. Now, if I were to ask you, is that in this respect, is it similar to or dissimilar to the Arch of Titus?
It's similar.
Okay? Yeah. Similar to, right?
Yes.
You take a look back at the Arch of Titus.
It's the same basic
right?
structure.
You see, it seems pretty, again, it's not as detailed on the Arch of Titus, but that part seems to be roughly the same. Okay?
A little hard to chisel out of stone to make all the details.
Even the base.
Or gold.
Look at the base.
Well, the base we're going to have to talk about. Okay?
Was that similar?
Yeah, what do you have there? It is, but we'll have to talk about it.
How do we explain the discrepancy between the two different renderings of the menorah's base? Some clues to this mystery are suggested by the ornamental designs that appear in Titus' menorah.
Good. We're going to get there, though. That's part two. You're jumping ahead.
Yeah, the images have been eroded over time. It is possible to discern messages of such figures as eagled and fish-tailed sea serpents or dragons. A similar base has been excavated from the Roman temple at Didymus, now in southern Turkey. And then it goes on to tell about each. The eagles were, of course, the best-known symbol of Roman sovereignty. The dragons were a popular decorative motif in Roman art, and the candelarium seemed to testify to the strong Roman influence. There are, however, some striking differences between Titus's candelabrum and its pagan counterparts. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to go on with it?
Well, what we're gonna do is we're gonna use this. We're gonna have to come back to this.
So should I read it?
What?
Let's do it.
We can come back to this also to what you read also. Let's come back. Let's hold that, and we're gonna come back to it. That's gonna be very helpful. Really interesting. Fascinating. Thank you. Awesome. That's really great. So what I want to do is for this piece, though, is to ask ourselves about the shape of the branches, and though, before we get to the base, which is going to be part two. It's going to be really interesting. But what was the shape of the branches of the menorah? So if you read the verses here, it doesn't really say.
It just says a shaft.
Okay. It says a shaft. It's not really clear. Right now we're used to circular. We see a lot of circular, yeah. And in fact, if you take a look on right, if you take a look in our picture that we just gave out, it's a semicircle. The Arch of Titus we just pointed out in source number 3 we saw is a semicircle. We'll come back to the symbol, right, the emblem of the state of Israel. But if you just look there quickly in number 4, right, in source number 4, it's a semicircle. Right, everyone has me. I'm on page 2 in the stapled source sheet. Right, it's a semicircle in the state of Israel. So the question is, where does this come from? So here's what's interesting. If you take a look at I gave you 2 medieval commentaries. If you take a look at sources 2 and 5 on your source sheets, okay? 2 and 5 on the source sheets, okay? One of them, okay, everyone has me? I'm on the second page of the stapled handout at the very top where it says in the English, Ibn Ezra. I want to explain Ibn Ezra. Anyone familiar with the name?
Yes,
Abraham Ibn Ezra,
yeah,
right? We're familiar with that.
The books, the Tanakh together.
He was one of the classic medieval commentaries on Chumash, on the Torah. Abraham Ibn Ezra lives in the 11th century, essentially. 11th to the 12th century. And he is a Spanish commentary. He is from Spain. So take a look at what he says about the construction of the branches of the menorah. And he writes in source 2, and the explanation of 6 branches. He says, what are these 6 branches? Round, long, hollow. Okay? Round, long, hollow. Each of those is interesting. For our purposes, which is the relevant word?
Round.
Right? Round. Okay? So does Ibn Ezra agree with or disagree with what we've seen so far? Right? You think he disagrees?
Yes.
How so?
Because he agrees. You said that this is flat on the other side. It's round here on the outside.
No.
So the semicircle is what? Like this?
No, this is the semicircle.
No.
This is the semicircle.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the arms. Sorry.
No. Right. Good. So then it ends up being. It ends up right. So then
but
it ends
he
up.
Made it up because. Well, we don't.
It's not. No. It's his own explanation. It doesn't appear in the text. That's correct. It's hard to prove it from the text itself. Now, take a look, for example, though, at Rashi. Mm-hmm. Look at source number 5. Rashi says, right? Rashi also one of the great classic medieval commentaries. Right? He's not Spanish. He is from. Right? He's French. Right, Rashi is from France. He lives 1040 to 1105. Of course, one of the greatest commentators, really, of our history. Right? Okay. He's all of our buddy. He's really so significant for our tradition. Right? Rashi's on the side, printed on the time of the Talmud. If you're printed on the side of the Talmud, you know you've made it. Right? That's a good sign. That's right. Okay. Source number 5. Take a look at Rashi. Emerging from its sides on either side in.
A diagonal.
Plot thickens. What was the shape of the menorah? You know, I don't know. I really don't know. What I do know is that Maimonides drew a picture of the menorah in his commentary to the Mishnah. Okay, take a look in source 6. Maimonides writes in his commentary to one of the sections of the Mishnah, I saw fit to draw here. right? The shape of the menorah in its completeness. Take a look at side at the next side, at page 3. I gave you the picture. This is literally the handwriting of Maimonides. Okay, the original manuscript.
Which one?
No. This is the picture that he drew.
Side 3.
Yes,
side 3.
Oh, that one? Yeah. On top. Okay? On top. This is his graph of the menorah. Now, obviously, this is just a sketch. This is not actually exactly how it looks.
It doesn't
have all the parts.
It came way after this Roman identified it.
Okay. Hold on. Yeah. So hold on 1 second. Great. Great point. It's 1,000 years later. Almost. That's right. 100%. So historically, it is, right, it's more suspect. 100%. So we're going to get there in a second. But if I were to ask you, if you just take a look at the sketch of Maimonides, you even see his Arabic writing on top, by the way. Okay, it's probably his handwriting in Arabic on the top, where he describes, I'm going to pass on translating the Arabic for you, only because I need to brush up on my otherwise strong Arabic. You'll forgive me. So I actually have a friend whose wife is grew up speaking Persian and Arabic, and she's studying to be what? That's right, and she's studying to become, for lack of a better term, a spy. Yeah. Aramaic difference.
It's different.
Wait, what was the question? Sorry? Wait, what's the question?
The question was, I wonder if that was a period when Aramaic...
This is a subsequent period. They're speaking... He's living in Spain, but it's under Arabic rule. Aramaic typically was spoken prior to the Arab conquest of the 7th century. So they're a little bit... It's a somewhat later time than the Aramaic. All right, so... Maimonides leaves out many details, and it's certainly not meant to be an actual, right, an actual rendering of the menorah, that's for sure. But if I were to ask you, right, diagonal around, what is he, right? He's got the bowls, he's got the knobs. I don't know, it looks pretty diagonal to me. Now, you could say maybe he didn't have so much room on his paper, and maybe it's just a little bit, it's just a quick sketch, and he wasn't really interested in that. Right? You could say that's right.
He said it was in its completeness.
You could, right? Right? You could try to say that, but it's a little bit misleading if it's just, you know, if you really thought they were round, this is a little bit funny. The problem is, right, what question could we ask against Maimonides and Rashi, for that matter, both of whom say diagonal, it would seem. What's the source? What?
How does the oil stay in the bowl? If it's a diagonal, it's going
to... Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and Maimonides, actually, some of them are leaning over, and some of them are straight. Now, if you look at the second one from the left, it's kind of evened out. You see that?
That one's
right. Yeah.
It's not clear if it could support itself so easily. That's right. But I guess if it's one piece of gold that was hammered out, then maybe it's stronger.
I don't think how you could make this one.
It's hard, right? It's not so easy.
How is it resolving the distance?
He did not believe that it was equidistant. But neither does the round one, right? If you think it's round, they're not equidistant from the center either.
But he said it was in its completeness.
Looks like it is.
No, but they have to be equal. The point of equidistance is that they're equidistant from the center branch. But they can't be by definition unless it's actually a full circle in the round.
How could he have figured that this was a complete drawing? Because clearly...
So that's the question. It's clearly imperfect. It's clearly incomplete. Right. In its completeness. I don't know. I don't know what completeness means. I mean, it's not...
Maybe he's using it a different way than we do.
Yeah, it's part of the problem of translations from Arabic. We have to be careful. He wrote in Arabic. I'm not sure exactly, you know, with subtleties like that, you have to be careful in translation. I don't know for sure. Yeah.
When the Jews returned from exile... in Rome,
mm-hmm.
were they able to bring back their menorah or not? Because otherwise, there's no concrete evidence
we have
the temple menorah for anybody to say it was this, it was that, it was the other thing. Other than
that's right, we have no idea. You know, we've been imagining that it was hidden at the Vatican for the last 2,000 years, right? In fact, the Sephardic chief rabbi, not the current one, but the prior one. Rabbi Amar, chief rabbi of Israel, he had an audience with the Pope a few years back, and he almost couldn't help himself. And he, of course, asked the Pope, you know, are there any, do you happen to have, while we're discussing world peace, I was just curious, right? So he actually asked whether or not, I think he asked about the menorah specifically and the temple vessels in general.
They're not going to give it.
They're not going to give it anyway. So that's right. So the Pope, what? The Pope said no. Who knows? The truth is that the historical evidence, the best that we have it, the archaeological evidence, does not support it at all. It does not support it being in the Vatican. There's good reason to think it's not in the Vatican. But it's not as good a story if it's in the Vatican. Yeah. So there's
they
a little bit of there's some tension there. That's right. It's much more interesting to believe that it's in the Vatican somewhere.
The Vatican wasn't built then.
No, it was not in the Vatican back then. That's
there
that much
no
we know. There was no Vatican.
Vatican.
That's right. No. There was no Vatican.
This melted down.
That's true. Yeah. Wait. So what?
I want to know if gold was as valuable metal then as it is.
I don't know how, but it was clearly extremely valuable. Yeah. There's no question. It was very valuable.
Going back to Sumerians, they worked in gold.
That's right. Yes.
Obviously, it was a prized.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
They,
yes. There is historical evidence. Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that
was. Kings, queens, whatever. Yeah, it was.
More so than silver back then also, right? Mm-hmm. 100%. Okay. Now, so here we have some question. We have a little bit of a problem. We have different medieval scholars are differing. Some say round, some say diagonal. Some give sketches that we're not 100% sure what to make of, but they seem diagonal at first glance. Now, the Arch of Titus, though, is round. And the Arch of Titus is the only, basically, pretty much the only archaeological evidence that we have, and was roughly contemporaneous with the destruction of the temple. This portrayal was in the immediate aftermath of the destruction of the second temple in the year, roughly the year 70 or 68 of the Common Era. So this is the best that we have. So where Maimonides and Rashi get off with diagonal seems a little bit funny.
Also, okay. Israel chose to make it because it's identical to this.
Yeah, we're going to get
there. They accepted this as being.
That's right. The state of Israel certainly takes that from took the Arch of Titus model, that's for sure. Now, what's interesting, though, is that the diagonal menorahs, despite the Arch of Titus and the rounds sort of having been popular, the diagonal menorahs have begun to make something of a comeback. And they've become more common in the popular sphere. Because if I were to ask you, outside of Israel, certainly, if who puts up menorahs in public places? Right? Who usually does it? Right? Lubavitch, Chabad, Lubavitch, 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 right? They're the ones doing it. On the car, the whole nine yards. You go to Acme, they'll do it like they always do. Okay? It's all over the place. The Lubavitch Rebbe, who was considered to be the decisor for that community, he believed that Maimonides was correct. He believed that it should be, diagonal.
Right.
That's what the Lubavitcher Rebbe maintained.
Maimonides probably was never in Rome.
What?
Maimonides didn't see that thing.
I don't have to convince me. I'm not. If I made a menorah, it would be in the round. But that was what he maintained.
How do you keep oil in a diagonal container?
That's what we were discussing earlier. It's not so simple. Yeah, I agree with that. That's not so simple. But if you take a look at source number 8, you will see that the Lubavitcher Rebbe says this. He says, and he has some uncomfortable words to say about the Arch of Titus. He says, Rashi, this is source 8, following the basic meaning of the text, states that, I'm not sure how he knows that it's the basic meaning of the text, that it's diagonal as opposed to round, states that the branches of the menorah extended upward from its main stem in straight diagonal lines, not curved, as commonly depicted. This reading of the text is supported by an illustration in Maimonides' own hand, which likewise shows straight diagonal branches. Okay, so far what we've seen.
And mind.
What? And what?
In Maimonides' own hand and mind.
Right, okay, fair enough. Good. But he was agreeing with Maimonides, that's right. He says, the common practice of depicting the menorah with curved branches derives from the infamous Arch of Titus, erected by the Roman emperor to celebrate his defeat of the Jews and his destruction of the temple, in which a menorah with curved branches is shown being triumphantly carried off to Rome, and which bears the inscription, Judah Captive. The curved branches are only one of the many inaccuracies in this menorah, which differs in numerous ways, and we're going to have to go back to this, from the Torah's specifications. It is most fortunate that for many Jews, the image of the menorah is as depicted on an arch constructed to celebrate the temple's destruction, rather than as described by the Torah and its traditional commentaries. I therefore urge that every effort be made to correct this error by taking care to always draw the menorah with diagonal branches and to follow this model in all representations of the menorah, such as menorahs used for the kindling of Hanukkah lights and so on, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And if you took a look at Source 9, you will see, and you can go on the internet, and you can simply Google these days, Lubavitch menorah, and you will see any number of hundreds, and I don't know, thousands or whatever, hundreds and hundreds of Lubavitch menorahs from around the world, and you'll see them at their candle lighting ceremonies with all the dignitaries in like some, you know, some far off Russian province or something like that. And you will see, always see.
This is
right here. You have it right here in Narber.
When I live downtown,
and you will always downtown. You will always see what it's about. Now you know where it comes from. The Lubavitch menorah is always diagonal, always. And now you know where it comes from.
This is not a perfect, though.
It's just that they put supersized wicks, not real wicks, but like, you know,
those
branches. Those are the candles. That's
but
right.
They should put oil.
What?
Well,
it might be that up there they have oil. I'm not sure. Hard to say.
Whatever it is, okay? Stuck in the
This
top.
Is, I think it's a picture from Phoenix or something like that. I don't remember. But they're all the same in that all the Lubavitch menorahs are all diagonal. Now, right? Now, there are those who may disagree, and there certainly are those who disagree, but sometimes when everyone just goes out and does something, and you're everywhere, right, you affect at least the public perception
of
it. God bless. So that's really a fascinating phenomenon. So this is... I don't see why he says, I agree, I don't understand why he says that Rashi following the basic meaning of the text, I don't know why it's more basic, especially if they might fall out the wicks. So as has been pointed out, they're diagonal. So I'm not sure how he came to that as the basic meaning of the text. That's what he says, I'm not 100% sure. But you also see his antagonism toward the Arch of Titus, right? I mean, he's not very subtle about that. This is just
infamous,
a record. This
not
is,
famous.
Right?
Infamous.
That's right. It's the infamous, right? It's very unfortunate. He's not happy about this situation. And part of his way of pushing back against the Arch of Titus as a symbol, right, for Hanukkah, basically, is to say, no. Make it diagonal, right? Different, right? It should be different than the way that it's depicted there. So that was the classic position of Lubavitcher Rebbe, and that's one detail which I think is really interesting that I wanted to share with you with regard to the construction of the menorah. And now what I come to now is the second detail. And here's the second detail, which is what I wanted to come back to, we had been discussing earlier, in terms of the base of the menorah. And this is very interesting. If you take a look at the Arch of Titus itself, so go back with me to number 3. And we had already had, right, a description, right, that was read. Now, this is really hard to see. But if you take a look, right, you see the base of the menorah, the curved branches of the menorah in the Arch of Titus. And while they're not really visible, you can't really make them out, in the stapled sheet back to source number 3 on the Arch of Titus picture. Okay.
No,
that's not for me. That was.
Here it is.
Okay. Side two
of the stapled source sheets. Okay, side two. Yeah, the top picture is source number 3. Okay, if you take a look at the base of the menorah, it's hard to see. But if you were to magnify, very hard to see, but it was already described. If you were, well, yeah, it is exactly what Israel adopted. It's hard, yeah, it's a square shape. But if you were to magnify this and look at it in color, etc., you would see some very unusual shapes and animals that are depicted on the actual base here. You would see, as was described, we read it earlier, right? What's here? Serpents. Okay? And other kinds of animals that are depicted on this Roman base of the menorah. Now, that's strange because in Judaism, would we expect to have sea serpents on the menorah inside the temple?
No.
That does not. Have you ever seen a sea serpent depicted in a synagogue, temple, etc.? Right? That doesn't sound very Jewish. What does it sound to you?
Like the devil.
Sounds Roman. It sounds pagan. It is Roman. It is pagan. Right? Absolutely. It is pagan. As was described earlier, there were other symbols of worship in various pagan temples that were contemporaneous to the time period of the Second Temple, Roman in particular, that had sea serpents and other kinds of animals that were used to describe the characteristics of their pagan gods, of their divinities.
The serpent in Moses, you know.
What?
Moses, the king, that took the serpent.
Okay, that's true. I don't mean to say it's completely out of court, but you never have this in...
It's not part of their time.
Right, it's possible. It's possible, but there's no other description. We have descriptions of what the temple looked like, the menorah looked like in the temple. You don't find this is the only thing. Correct. That's true, on the fabric. But this on the temple itself.
Is there something that says that it's six-sided because it's six-sided?
What's six-sided?
The base has six sides.
Oh, so we're going to have to talk about that. This base. What?
Do we have any archaeological evidence of either floors or on a wall which depicts a menorah from ancient times?
We don't think we have anything else like this. Not that I know of. This is the primary piece of evidence. Anything else we have is from much later synagogues, but they're already hundreds of years later, prior to the Arch of Titus, because things didn't really last from that time. So we haven't found anything like in a cave or anything like that during the Bar Kokhba revolt. There's nothing like that. There is subsequent historical evidence, and I think the historical evidence it's later. So what is it worth relative? You know, you also have Rashi and Maimonides. They're also later, so they are. You know, it's not so authoritative. Yeah.
It says here, except is correct that the images were on there. It says if this is correct, then the menorah that was plundered by the Roman legions was not the symbol of religious freedom that had been created by the Maccabees, but a despot's monument of foreign oppression.
Right. So that's going to be, we're going to talk about that's going to be Herod. So we're going to have to get there in just a minute. 100%. Exactly right. So the question is where this came from. And I'll add that actually, if you take a look at many of the traditional sources, it seems that the base of the menorah was probably a tripod. Now, we don't have that here, but I didn't give you the sources for it. But there is evidence that it's actually a tripod. I'm trying to look and see if you can't see it. One second.
This looks like more than three because you can see three and there is something behind.
Where are you? Yeah, no, it's not like it is in the Arch of Titus. Maimonides is not... If you look at Maimonides, that's a great point. If you look at Maimonides, he's got these tiny little something that's jutting out three places from the bottom. It does look like a tripod. Yeah, right. That's exactly right. 100%. It's not. You can't really see it on the picture that I gave you, but if you take a look at this, at their model, at the bottom, it's obscured here because there's a placard there from the donor, actually. But there's actually, if you look at the Machon HaMikdash's replica, they also have a tripod. You can't really see it clearly. But like Maimonides alludes to it, that's their picture as well. Now again, do we have historical archaeological evidence? Not necessarily. So here's the question. The question that emerged was really as follows. Is the Arch of Titus really representative of what was? Maimonides has a tripod. Others have tripods. Right? Where are these sea dragons? Where did those come in? Right? Now, so there are those who have suggested, like the Lubavitch Rebbe said, they said, well, that's because the Arch of Titus is not really an archaeological representation of the menorah. What were the Romans doing?
They were telling
their own story. They were co-opting the story. Okay, what do you think about that? Does that work?
We all do.
Are there any? Okay.
This is what man has always done with history.
Okay.
But they wanted it for their use.
The winner gets to write history.
Okay, that's where we're going to go, as was already mentioned.
They were known for, doing the images for whatever happened, historical things, so to carry down. Mm-hmm. I mean, Herod was very into putting his victories down and the sign that they were. So
the Herod piece we're going to get back to, but we're up to the Romans still. right? In other words, if the Romans themselves, see to me, the suggestion that the Romans intentionally misconstrued the menorah in this picture, I think that that's very strange. I don't see why they would have done that. If you would, yeah, you could disagree. That's why I'm just, this is my own thought.
If you capture something, you want to show what you captured.
Right, I would say that the strength of the Romans would be evident in the fact that they showed the Jews' menorah as existed, being the real menorah, the historical menorah, being carried away, plundered by the enemy. Which is a greater symbol it would be the exact menorah. That menorah that the Jews used in their worship. It's ours now. It's gone. That's right. So that's what, to me, it's possible. Maybe in sort of recalor or sort of showing we've somehow co-opted this symbol. Maybe they would have, but to me, it would be simpler if they would have left it. It seems strange. Right. So it would be the exact.
And this is so important.
That's what I would have thought as well. But that just begs the question then. Tripod with sea serpents, what's going on? So the suggestion that has been offered, and this is what we were discussing, what was mentioned, is that maybe, and this is tragic and sad, but maybe Herod himself, who is considered to be an anti-traditionalist among the various kings, who was himself a Jewish king, but who was heavily influenced by Hellenism, we know that he remade the temple. In many phases, and actually at one point, it's not well recorded, but there are allusions in Josephus and elsewhere, that actually there was another tribe that came and plundered part of the temple years before it was actually destroyed, and that it was during the reign of Herod, and that he commissioned a reconstruction of the temple. We know that he redid the whole Temple Mount, and he did a lot of very ambitious work in the area of the temple, but there has been a suggestion, we don't know for sure, but it seems logical to suggest that he himself reconstructed even some of the vessels of the temple after it was plundered. If that was the case, right, then maybe, but this would be a tragedy.
If that's the case,
but
it
might be a historical tragedy. So the suggestion that has been offered by a number of historians is to suggest that what happened was, tragically, Herod had already reconstructed the menorah in the temple after the image of Hellenism. And after the image of paganism. And so, right, both positions can be true. And so that what we can understand is the Romans were showing the real spoils of war. You know what the spoils of war were at that time? A pagan depiction on the menorah. And that might be really what's going on over here. And that's what's been suggested. Right, which is very interesting. Now, in light of that, I would ask you a question. We know that Israel shows the Arch of Titus, though, as its image. So this gets complicated now, right?
If this is a menorah that Herod may have constructed or controlled, and it doesn't agree with what the Bible requires,
right,
then we don't have to follow that.
Right.
We can make our own interpretation of what the Bible wants.
That's right. So some have suggested, therefore, that they expressed concerns about the symbol of the state of Israel. They said, well, why are you using this menorah as the symbol? And that's the question.
Images in the base there in the rectangles look like...
It's the same images as the Arch of Titus.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's not clear, but it is. And that was the basis for it. So this became, there was actually a dispute around the time of the founding of Israel. There are those who say, don't use the Arch of Titus. They didn't necessarily know this theory about Herod. But there were those who said, don't use the Arch of Titus. We should use a different menorah, a more traditional version of the menorah. And there was some discussion about exactly how to do this. But that's sort of, right, that's part of the struggle of what it means to be a modern state of Israel. We want to be true to tradition. At the same time, there's a historical context. We want to add that we have peaceful intentions, which is the olive branches that go around it. I think it's an interesting question. What I think ultimately comes back to, though, is that the story of the menorah, the story of the Arch of Titus, is sort of, to me, is a story for our search for sort of our roots. I think in many ways. And I think that it's really about sort of recapturing that sense of self and who we are and sort of what we represent. And I think that it's very moving. It's a very moving story in that way. So I just wanted to, happy to take questions a second, but I just wanted to, I just certainly wanted to say that to me, the story of the menorah, and again, the story of Hanukkah in general, is really about what we said at the outset. It's about going back to our roots. It's about seeing how Judaism and how the symbols of Judaism have played out over the course of the centuries, about trying to reconstruct that, I think, with authenticity. I think it's very beautiful. But also, I think it also goes back to the menorah as a symbol of our own independence, that what we're really looking for is the sense of our own menorah, that the modern state of Israel gives us an opportunity to go back to that sense that we provide light, which then goes outward, that we can be a beacon of light to all the peoples of the world. And hopefully this Hanukkah will continue to realize that as individuals, for our families, and as an entire people. So that's what I wanted to say. Now I want to hear from you.
It's in here somewhere that I can't find. In modern day, today, it says, Jews do not walk through the Arch of Titus. They walk around it.
Mm-hmm. Like the Lubavitcher Rebbe would. Yeah. It's that kind of thing, you know? Right. We wouldn't...
What about the now, I mean, I was told that...
Go that way.
Walk on the, that's like they used to walk on the other side of the street from the church, that kind of thing, right?
That it was a kosher menorah, or whatever you want to call it, as long as they were level. So now they make all different kinds of ones, but as long as the candles are all on the same mm-hmm. level and equal, then it's a, then yes. it's a kosher.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
I thought the shamus in fact, has to be...
A different one. No, she's saying not the shamash. She's saying the other ones. The other candles. That's right. It's actually, you know, you can even construct, most assume you can actually construct a menorah. If you're stuck, you can actually put separate candles. It doesn't have to be one unit. Like, let's say you're stuck somewhere without a menorah, but you have candles. So you know what you could do? You could stick each candle, you can melt the bottom of it. Let's say you have tin foil, right? You have matches, tin foil, and candles. Right. And it's the eighth night, you want to light eight, all right? All the lights. Yeah. So you can just stick them, you melt the bottom, you just stick them onto the tin foil. And one of the, actually, one of the versions of the historical versions of what happened when the Jews retook the temple is that actually they did not have the menorah because it had been impurified or physically broken, whatever it may have been, and damaged. And so actually according to one version, they took spears and they took them and they stuck them in the ground. And then they put oil on top of the spears with wicks or whatever, something, some sort of cup on top of that. And that's how they lit it. And they put eight spears in the ground, or seven spears, I guess, in the temple. And then they lit across them. So it's really very interesting. So it's they have to be straight, but they don't necessarily even have to be part of a single structure.
Yeah, they sell boxes like that with them separate. I guess it's for traveling, you know, where you can...
Yeah, just put out the glass ones. Yeah. So look, be careful, though. They're a little dangerous.
Something about another tribe having decimated the temple.
Yes,
before.
Yeah.
I never read that.
I forget the name offhand. I think the name may have been the Parthians, but I don't remember the exact details. And I don't know if that's for sure that that's the name. I remember that vaguely. So Herod is ruling, I'm trying to think, maybe 100 plus years before the destruction of the temple. A little bit, maybe a little bit longer, a little bit earlier than that. So that would have been around the time. And that was when Hellenism was beginning to really pick up steam and pose a serious challenge.
This is the second temple.
Second temple, yeah.
When you light the menorah, mm-hmm. we're told there's a specific order in the sense that you go from left to right and not mm-hmm. from right to left.
That's an interesting. That's a separate. What? That's.
I want to hear his answer.
No, that's fine. It's a separate question.
Wait, could you just repeat? Jordan, what did you ask?
That's right.
So you like the newest one?
That's yeah. The idea is that the idea is not so much that it's the left to right, but it's we put them in right to left, which is like. In Judaism, you have this. Sometimes you start with the right side first. This is—it's really based on mysticism. It's based on the Kabbalah, but we find that idea. You know, some people even tie their right shoes before they tie their left shoes. You might be familiar, etc. So we have that. But then the idea is not so much left to right, but the idea is that really we start with you know, if there's a new opportunity to perform a mitzvah, we want to take advantage of that newest opportunity and to make it fresh.
Okay.
So we do that one, and then we work from there. So that seems to be the idea. All right.
Okay.
Good. Well, I thank everyone as always for a wonderful learning opportunity.
Thank you.
Let's make sure that we have. Thank you. We'll stop here.